Good morning, which is number 013870, the United States against Guy J. Westmoreland. Mr. Rosenblum.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Rosenblum. I'm arguing on behalf of the appellant Guy Westmoreland. I also served as Mr. Westmoreland's appellant counsel in Westmoreland 1, which has been referred to in the briefs, and I served as his trial counsel in representing him on the fourth superseding indictment in the Southern District, where he was charged and ultimately convicted with alternative counts of murder. I'd like to address the first two points, time permitting, in appellant's brief, that is that it was error to admit the testimony, the statement of his wife, Ronnie Westmoreland, and further that it was error, the testimony, in fact, that she was told by Mr. Westmoreland on January 2nd that he had provided co-defendant Richard Abelin the name of a hitman and his telephone number in derogation of the marital privilege.
Under your argument, can a wife who participates in an offense after the fact testifies to statements made after she began participating but not to statements before she began participating?
Our argument, and I think it's clear, and I think it's clear in the Seventh Circuit, that if the marriage is intact, that the marital privilege will protect any statements made during the course of that marriage with three exceptions. That exception being whether or not a third party was present, and also whether or not there was a joint venture.
How can a court determine when that participation began? Couldn't her action in concealing evidence here indicate that she may have been complicit all along?
Well, it would be our opinion that you can't look beyond the evidence and the facts to determine what's going in a person's mind, and you have to base the decision and the admission of the evidence on the evidence before the court at the time. In this particular instance, I think, and also looking at the case law, looking at the Neal case out of the Tenth Circuit, when looking at the facts as to whether or not an individual is an accessory after the fact, I think it's a fact-specific inquiry as to whether or not they're an accessory after the fact of that particular crime. In this case, at best, the argument is that Bronnie Westmoreland had knowledge of a drug conspiracy. When you look at the facts in this case, there was no evidence linking her to any involvement in the murder conspiracy. In fact, the tape that was made between co-defendant Abelin and Bronnie Westmoreland after the January 2nd statement would indicate that she had no knowledge and even no suspicion by the questions that she was asking Mr. Abelin and by the suggestions that she was making to Mr. Abelin at that time. The facts of this case would show that Bronnie Westmoreland, at best, the only fact, the only wrongdoing, at best, at her husband's behest, after the time that he was arrested in early January, assisted a fellow by the name of Runyon to destroy a blue Dodge pickup truck. The only evidence on this record as to why she was doing that and what her intent was that her husband, Guy Westmoreland, said to her, that pickup truck was used by DeAndre Lewis's, another co-defendant's cousin, in a drive-by. Nothing to do with this particular murder, and her intent would be not to be an accessory after the fact of the murder that is an issue here. Additionally, the case says, look at what's going on. Is the husband raising this privilege going to put her in a position where that she is going to be charged, where she then cannot testify, where she cannot then take benefit of being immunized by the government to help her or to assist her in her defense? That's not an issue here. The government never suggested she was a suspect. The government never charged her. She was not a target in this murder for hire. None of that was at issue, and in fact, she was not immunized. She was only immunized in this case as to her complicity in helping her husband break certain amounts of drugs during the course of the drug conspiracy.
Even if but we were, please go ahead.
On the blue van and her assistance in that, would her participation in the drug conspiracy, in addition to dealing with the blue van and cutting and packaging the cocaine, would that be sufficient to overcome a marital communications privilege?
No.
Why not?
Because I think when you're looking at the case, it looks to what are you an accessory after the fact of? And that was not what the government suggested, and that's not what how the government proffered this evidence. As the court has been apprised, the government first tried to proffer this evidence on the basis that there was a third-party communication.
Right.
And that fell apart pretty quickly after the testimony. And once Ms. Westmoreland testified, and it showed that this statement, which was proffered and offered as being as the marital privilege being violated because it was in the presence of a third party, and the court found no, there is no nexus between these two conversations. And it was after we moved for a mistrial, after we moved for what we believed appropriate remedy that the conversation be stricken. It was after that that the government says, oh, okay, now we're going to move again because of this joint venture, and cites the Neal case, the Tenth Circuit case, to say, well, she was an accessory after the fact in this murder conspiracy, period. She was not an accessory after the fact to this murder conspiracy. She didn't know about this murder conspiracy, and in the context of what was going on, and when you're looking at what Ms. Westmoreland was doing and how her testimony developed, she was, from all purposes and all intent and purposes, a dedicated wife during Westmoreland 1. It was after Westmoreland 1, where then it was divulged she was having an affair with a case agent. It was after that point in time where then she sought the witness protection program, and she came in and out of the witness protection program. It was after that point in time where then she started cooperating with the government, and we would, at the time prior to trial, when we started getting some of these statements, was when the first time that we saw this alleged statement. For the government now, and it's also disturbing to me that the government in this case and in Westmoreland 1 consistently asked the district court judge to walk way out on the limb when it came to evidentiary rulings, and it seems to me because the government felt assured we can now come to this court and say, well, it was plain, it was harmless error.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Why, assuming you are correct on the admission of this evidence, or why isn't it harmless error?
The cold record obviously is difficult to translate the impact of the spoken word at a trial. But in our view, it's not harmless view. The government says, well, there was 2 days of Bronnie Westmoreland's testimony, and this was 2 pages in 355 total pages. Well, that's not well taken. If an eyewitness stands up and says, that's the man, if it's one sentence, it can be devastating. And in this particular case, that statement was devastating. There was no statement coming out of Guy Westmoreland's mouth directing him or linking him to this hitman, to DeAndre Lewis. There were circumstances that were arguable. There was the tape, but at the same time, at no time in the tape did Mr. Westmoreland implicate himself directly in this murder. The only thing that at times in the tape, we certainly argued the opposite effect in the tape that was introduced at evidence. In fact, he said to Ablin, go another direction, settle it a different way. The rest of the evidence against Westmoreland on the murder conspiracy was the two co-defendants for the most part, and his conduct while on vacation that his wife, we believe, obviously could appropriately testify to, because you can testify to conduct. But that was just as arguable because he was nervous that this man's been arrested and he's been involved in a drug conspiracy. So now we're left with Ablin, who got a deal and who testified 18 different ways. I couldn't even count them during the course of the trial. DeAndre Lewis, who was given a deal, a substantial deal that he testified to in exchange for his trial testimony, and also testified to
what is the deal?
Mr. Ablin's deal was that the government waived the death penalty and allowed him to plead to life in the penitentiary. Mr. Lewis's deal was that he pled to, I believe, 30 years, and the government agreed to file a Rule 35 asking for a departure of up to a third off, and we calculated it at trial, so he was going to be saved, or when he was testifying, he believed, I don't know whether the Rule 35 at this point has actually been filed, but when he was testifying, it was his mind that he was going to get a substantial discount as being the trigger man, and he did not start testifying, he did not start cooperating until fairly late in the proceedings. And likewise, even when he testified, he, in my view, did not seem particularly trustworthy, also telling a number of different stories. Now we're left with, in our view, a very, very damning statement coming from Westmoreland's own wife, who really provides the only link between Westmoreland and this murder for hire conspiracy, coming out of his mouth to his wife. What's more troubling is that his wife, although she makes this statement in the tape, when her conversation is captured on January 5th, this statement, the conversation in that captured conversation, belies that she would have had knowledge of this statement. And now it appears after she starts cooperating, and then we have the additional troubling aspect of the case that the initial proffered foundation for this falls apart, and it appears that the government in its zeal wanted to get this statement in. It was incredibly, incredibly prejudicial to Guy Westmoreland to have his wife say that he provided Richard Aveling, in any context, the name of the hitman and the name of the telephone number, and then went over to his house to make sure that he didn't use it. That was, in our view, very critical evidence.
On a different road, the government asserts that one of your defenses was that Mr. Westmoreland was not that committed to the drug conspiracy, and therefore could not have provided a motive. Do you concede that the defense included that argument? And
that he was not committed to the drug conspiracy?
That, yeah. Because, see, if you could, if the defense included that argument, seems to me that would make the scope of the conspiracy relevant. As well as any actions taken by him in the past to protect that drug conspiracy.
Mr. Westmoreland was convicted of the drug conspiracy, and that case was subsequently remanded for sentencing pursuant to Apprendi. Interestingly, he was convicted at that point. He was convicted. 90% of the evidence was basically evidence that has now been determined inadmissible pursuant to the Lilly case. Having said that, though, we conceded that he was involved in a drug conspiracy with Richard Aveling. He was convicted of it. We conceded it. We did not concede that that drug conspiracy had anything to do with Deborah Aveling's death. In fact, one of Richard Aveling's many statements and one of his last pronouncements was that the death occurred as a result of his greed, his lust, and his desire to get out of the marriage, and that at no point did we concede that it had anything to do with furthering the drug conspiracy.
Of course, the greed is the drug conspiracy, is it not?
The greed that we were talking about from Richard Aveling's point of view was his desire not to split half of his $17 million estate with his wife. And that was what he had said numerous times. That was his first pronouncement to the police. That's what he then changed to different theories. He then came back to it. And quite frankly, it was difficult, even during the course of his testimony, to really understand exactly what he was saying. But certainly, we felt that the murder conspiracy did not grow from the drug conspiracy. That case was exacerbated then in our second point, where the very last witness that this jury heard, the very last witness that the government called in its case in chief, was the testimony of Tammy Sharp. It did not offer it by way of 404B. I would have to imagine that the government knew that it would not qualify under 404B. We have Guy Westmoreland, who's charged with five different theories or counts of murder. The last witness in the case is Tammy Sharp. Tammy Sharp testifies that at some point in the summer preceding the murder, that she was home when her husband appears covered with blood. You can only assume when he then says, according to Tammy Sharp, that Chris Sharp says to Tammy Sharp that Guy Westmoreland and I just went out and killed this person and buried him where Westmoreland buries all his bodies. That was brutal, brutal evidence to put before a jury when considering the fate of a murder defendant on circumstantial evidence. I see my time has expired.
You have 1 minute. You're within your last minute.
Okay, I'm sorry. The government's, that particular evidence, though, dealing with Tammy Sharp, not only does the government offer that evidence, Tammy Sharp concedes that her husband was not believable. Tammy Sharp concedes that her husband was drug-addled. Tammy Sharp concedes all these other aspects, concedes that when she first talked to the police, she didn't raise this rather compelling evidence because she didn't have time. Nonetheless, under the theory of 801D, the government proffers this evidence as continuing a conspiracy. Chris Sharp was never charged, and it had nothing to do with the drug conspiracy at issue, and certainly nothing to do with the murder conspiracy. But this jury heard just brutal, brutal, prejudicial evidence that could not have done anything other than alter the outcome of this trial.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenblum. We'll hear now from Mr. Liggins.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Rosenblum. I have been the one of the attorneys, along with Kit Morrissey, assigned to the investigation and the two subsequent trials arising out of the murder of Deborah Ablin. The issues that we are deciding here this morning arise from the second trial that occurred in the course of this case. The first thing I guess I would like to note to the court is that all of the issues that are being raised by counsel, all six of the issues that he raises in his brief and the two that he raises before the court this morning, are evidentiary challenges to items of evidence that the district court admitted into evidence. I think that's important because it guides the standard of review that this court necessarily has to apply in addressing these issues.
Can you, can we just cut to the chase? And I want to find out, in your view, when did Westmoreland's wife become a joint participant in the murder conspiracy? Was this after the defendant's statement that he provided the number of a hitman? What's your view on that?
The way we argued it in the district court and the way we're going to argue it before this court was that she had suspicions that he was involved in the murder of Deborah Ablin that gelled into a solid belief, so that by the time that she was told to destroy the blue Dodge pickup truck, at that point she became a subject to co-conspirator or joint liability for her participation in the murder. So it is our position that that is the event that gave rise to the joint venture liability. Now, if taking that one step further, the issue becomes then, should the statement that was made on January 2nd be admitted when the scope of her joint liability didn't arise until approximately January 12th, January 13th. It is our position that it should. First and foremost, we relied upon the Neal decision out of the Tenth Circuit in advancing that argument to the court. One misimpression that I want to correct that counsel made this morning was that we raised Neal sort of out of the blue after the alternative foundation for that evidence came into question. That is not correct. If you look at the transcript of the June 11, 2001 motion in limine hearing, we raised this issue at that time before Bronnie Westmoreland testified. We advanced to the court two theories of admissibility. The first was that the statement was later repeated in front of her parents or in front of the defendant's parents at Terre Haute prison. And our alternative theory, and I believe I might have even said it's a better theory, was the Neal decision out of the Tenth Circuit.
But isn't Neal a little different from our situation because that court found that the testifying spouse became an accessory concurrent with the defendant's statement to her?
That is certainly a fact in the case. I don't know that it changes the calculus, especially when once you look at the way that this court and, in fact, every court in the nation has viewed privileges. The way privileges are viewed is that they are to be construed as narrowly as possible because they are, in fact, a derogation from the search for the truth. Now, if you proceed from that perspective, then if it is the fact that it is joint criminal liability that extinguishes the privilege, then the timing of that joint liability, it seems to me, shouldn't matter into the equation. Even, however, if you're not willing to accept our argument based on Neal, I would also point out, as I think I do in my brief, that this was the only statement that is being challenged by the defense as having been introduced into evidence in derogation of the marital privilege. And as this court ruled in United States versus Short, when you have extensive testimony from a spouse and when you have extensive testimony that is damning to the defendant's spouse, then the fact that one or two of those statements are introduced into evidence is really of no consequence. I also disagree with counsel's assertion that this statement was all that prejudicial. I mean, in fact, what Mr. Westmoreland said was that I gave Richard Ablin the number of someone who I thought might kill his wife, and I was just making sure that that didn't happen and that, in fact, person did not kill his wife. That was the statement that was introduced into evidence. I think you have to make a further level of harmless error inquiry, too, in the sense that while this statement was harmless in the context of the marital communications issue, it was also harmless in the context of the whole trial. And by that I mean we had evidence from the other co-conspirators in this case who gave corroborating type details, who told the same story with regard to this defendant's involvement in the case. I would correct counsel's assertion that DeAndre Lewis pled to 30 years. He entered an open plea of guilty to life. And with the assertion made that we would consider a Rule 35 down to less than that, but in no event would it be less than 30 years. Would his Rule 35 be less than 30 years?
Mr. Leggins, is Mr. Rosenblum correct when he states that in August of 2000 the case was decertified as a capital case when the government learned that its principal agent in the murder investigation had an affair with Mrs. Westmoreland?
I would only dispute that occurred in November of 2000 when it was actually decertified. We learned of it in August of 2000 and it was decertified then in November of 2000, I believe is the timing.
But would that be the reason for the decertification?
Yes, absolutely.
And how would the case have been tried differently? How does it factor in? In other words, how would the case have been tried differently, life imprisonment or a capital case?
If that had not happened? Mm-hmm. Well, assuming that it went to trial, it would have gone to trial as a capital murder case.
But what I'm trying to get to is, what would you have done differently here?
You mean with these evidentiary issues?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done anything differently, Your Honor. I believe every legal argument that we made with regard to evidentiary issues were perfectly reasonable. I believe that the type of evidence he's talking about would have come in anyway at a sentencing hearing. Certainly at the capital murder phase, if I'm understanding your question correctly. Would the fact that it was a capital murder case have changed the government's view? It wouldn't have. I mean, evidence is either admissible or it's not admissible. And
did anyone with personal knowledge testify that the tape recordings accurately reflected the conversation?
I believe Richard Ablin testified to that, Your Honor. I guess we're now getting into an issue that has not been argued this morning, but if you're going into, I believe it's issue number 3 in the brief, the issues regarding the foundation of the tape were, I guess part of the problem was that the technician actually sitting in the room died prior to trial. The court made note of the fact that the defense had those tapes tested by a forensic tape person, that an adequate and effective foundation had been laid for those during the first Westmoreland trial, and it would be our position that the I believe it was the testimony of Richard Ablin that those tapes reflect the conversations that he had with Richard Ablin on January 5th and January 6th. And when you look at this court's decision, and I cited in my brief, I believe it's the Strigel case. This court has eschewed any formulaic analysis of the foundation requirements for a tape recording. And as long as There's people who are saying that the tape is what it purports to be, as long as there are surrounding circumstances, that the tape is what it purports to be. And in this case, there were agents who were conducting surveillance of Mr. Westmoreland during the time these conversations are going on. It is our position that there was a more than adequate foundation laid for this tape.
Well, there are sites in the that you give to the transcript where this testimony occurs. All I could find in terms of reviewing the transcript was that he listened to the tapes and he compared them to the transcript, but not that the tape and the transcript reflect the conversation. So not in terms of the site you give or the site appellant gives. Could you provide that site? I know he didn't argue that, but I don't think that the specific point you make that he specifically said that's what was said in the conversation, I don't think is in the transcript.
Your Honor, I would have to go back and look, because this was an issue that was also argued in a motion in limine pre-trial, and I believe the judge didn't rule on the admissibility of this tape at trial.
Okay.
He ruled on the admissibility of a pre-trial. This issue was raised pre-trial, and frankly, I apologize. I don't recall in the hearing of that, we may have laid a more extensive foundation for why it was admissible. I know we argued it in the plea.
And is that hearing part of our record? The transcript?
I believe it. If it's not, I will see that it is.
Let me take you somewhere else again. Was there any evidence at all that Mr. Westmoreland was involved in the decision to send the fabricated sentencing letter?
No. I mean, you mean any evidence that he directed that be done?
Yeah.
No.
Then how was it relevant? I mean, how would it impugn his integrity? It would only, if it impugned anyone's integrity, it would be the integrity of his family.
It wasn't offered to impugn anyone's integrity. The reason.
But that's what it does. It may not have been offered for that purpose, but that's what it did.
Well, Your Honor, I believe we have to confine ourselves for what was the reason it was offered and how was it actually used by the prosecution, particularly in our closing argument. And we did not argue that Mr. Westmoreland's family's integrity should be impugned because of this letter. We argued that there are conceptual gaps in the government's case. There are items missing that the explanation for why they are missing is because the defendant had people acting on his behalf, actively obstructing justice. They were destroying automobiles. They were destroying titles. They were destroying items of evidence which we could have used to corroborate our case if we could have found them. This letter was corroboration that type of activity was happening, and that's how we argued it, and that's what it was argued for. It was not used in any way that was meant to impugn the integrity of anyone. We just needed to explain why the car's missing, why are the titles missing, why are these other items of evidence missing.
And all of that doesn't impugn anyone's integrity.
It may. I mean, there may be a spillover effect, but that's not why it was offered. It was being offered to explain a conceptual and factual gaps in the government's case. And if I could go to the last.
Of course, that wouldn't be important unless that implicated the defendant.
It is important because we needed to the items that were missing.
Yeah, but by implication, that was implicating the defendant, and the defendant had his fingerprints on it.
I don't know. I would disagree with you, with all due respect, Your Honor. I believe it would still, even if he had nothing to do with it, it allowed us to explain, for example, why the car titles to the Suburban that had the cocaine in it, why that was missing. It corroborated the accounts that people were actively destroying evidence on the
What people? The family?
The family. That was what the testimony
and
was.
And that doesn't impugn the family's integrity? They're destroying evidence. They're writing these letters. I just am trying to get through to your thought process here.
The thought process was, truly, we were not trying to impugn anyone's integrity. We were trying to provide corroborating evidence to support why it was that we did not have all of the facts, all of the items that we could have had to corroborate the evidence in this case. Finally, if I could get to the Tammy Sharp issue. The point I made to the district court and the point that I would make to this court was that, and I think I said it to the district court, if you look at this evidence, it sounds bizarre. It looks gruesome, but the first thing you have to remember is that this, after all, was a murder case. There were 5 counts of murder charged. The types of corresponding evidence that is going to be admissible in that kind of a case is by necessity going to be prejudicial. Had this been a felon in possession of a firearm case, I agree that this evidence would not be admissible. But this was not that case. This was a case where the defendant was charged with 5 counts of murder. I'd also point out to the court that we did not argue this evidence in an irresponsible manner. We did not argue that you should find Guy Westmoreland guilty of murder because Tammy Sharp made this statement that her husband told her. If you look at the closing argument, I believe it's volume 16, page 39 and 40, it shows how this argument was used in closing argument. And the way it was used is the jury was told all of this evidence for all of these arguments that Guy was not really committed to this conspiracy. I see my time is up. Can I finish my thought? That the notion that he was not committed to this conspiracy, the notion that he would not use violence or extreme means to protect this conspiracy, is belied by the fact that he would make up this type of scenario even if it was a hoax. And so for that reason, Your Honors, I would ask that you would affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leggins. Mr. Rosenblum had used his time. Let's see. Well, in the case will be taken under advisement. Mr. Rosenblum, we do want to thank you for having taken this case by appointment.